Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview, recorded on Monday the 18th of October 2021. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Simon Laffin, who's author of Behind Closed Doors, and he's going to delve into some of the issues and controversies that go on in boardrooms of listed companies and what investors should be aware of. Simon's also non-exec director at Dentsu Group and Watkin Jones. Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Can you tell us a bit about your background and what inspired the book?
Yeah, so I'm a finance man by background. I was CFO of Safeway for 10 years, and I've served since as a non-exec in public companies, private equity, as an NED, and as a chairman. So I've been 30 years on boards. And one of the things I feel so strongly about is that there isn't good training for both executive and non-executive directors. So I wanted to capture some of the learnings I've had in the last 30 years so I can pass it on to people so that they don't need to go through some of the pain I did to learn these lessons. So this is about just giving people lots and lots of advice and tips and information on how to react in different board circumstances.
And I think there's quite a lot that us investors can learn from your experience. So why are board politics and the book of relevance to investors?
Well, board decision making is about how companies make decisions. So it's got to be important to investors, understanding the board dynamics, what boards are worried about, what constraints they've got, is hugely important to understanding how a business works. And in the end, investors, and I'm a private investor too, we delegate responsibility for running the company to those directors. So everything we're doing is designed in there to make sure that the board needs to work to carry out decisions in the best interest of all the shareholders. I mean, after all, as private investors, we want to know that our power, the power we've given directors, is being used wisely.
And in your opinion, what are the most common problems in the boardroom?
I think they're the same as, any company. Strategy, use of cash, and people. To my mind, those are the three. You know, if you take them, strategy is obvious, isn't it? How do we direct our business? How do we grow our business? Use of cash is crucial. I mean, that might be paying the dividends. It might be acquiring companies. It might be investing in new capital equipment. And then thirdly, people. You've got to have the right people, not just at board level, but throughout the company. So if you had to sort of combine, the three things a board does, I think it is strategy, cash, and people.
And do you think boards are normally aligned? Do you think that the all board members share the same view, or is it better that they don't?
It's important that all board directors want the same thing in the end. So they're pulling in the interests of shareholders and other stakeholders. But it's also important that there's a bit of disagreement. And, the reality is you do want one or two people on the board who are a bit difficult, right, and have different views. And I've had directors on my boards that have driven me bonkers because they're very firm and they're challenging. And I normally go out and saying they drive me bonkers, but I'm bloody glad they're in that boardroom. So you do want, the last thing you want is identikit board directors and yes men. And one of the things I think distinguishes the really, really good, especially non-execs, are the people who are prepared to ask those questions and to challenge and to say no. Because too many times, boards get a proposal and you sit there, especially as a non-exec, but not exclusively, and you think, what is this? I'm not really sure I understand this proposal. I mean, what's really going on? And of course, in that situation, it's a lot easier just to say, oh, yeah, I'm sure they know what they're doing. Let's get it through. A really good non-exec doesn't do that. And one of the things I say in my book, one of my tips is do not agree to a proposal that you do not understand. Now, you might think that's barmingly basic. For goodness sake, you said to me, who would agree to something they don't understand? Well, I tell you what, rather a lot is the answer.
And what's the most uncomfortable board experience that you've ever had?
I think the worst is running out of cash. When you run out of cash, nobody is your friend. Nobody at all. And it's really difficult. I mean, I had a situation where, you know, we could see that we were going to be very tight on cash in 6 months' time. And we went to some of our equity shareholders. You can't say to them, we're running out, we think we might run out of cash in 6 months, because that would be price sensitive and you would make them insider. On the other hand, you're going to them and saying, how would you feel about an equity issue? And they say, an equity issue, but you're not performing very well. Why on earth would we put money in? And you're thinking, well, because we may need it. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the worst problem, because you're caught between wanting to involve investors in the decision, not being able to give them price sensitive, and not scaring them. And of course, when you're short of cash, the banks don't want to know, equity shareholders. And the worst situation I had was with Assura, which is a property company. It's now FTSE 250. Then it had a market cap of about 80 million. And we had a toxic derivative, right, as so many companies did post the 2008 crash. We had financing that the bank wanted to withdraw, and we didn't have enough cash to pay out for the toxic derivative, let alone refinance the debt. So we needed to clear out the toxic derivative, somehow refinance, and somehow raise equity. And obviously, shareholders won't come back and write you a new check unless they tell you you've got the debt sorted. The debt holders won't reschedule your debt until they know the equity. So you have to do all three things at once. And that was extremely difficult. And in the end, we started the board meeting at 2:30 a.m. in the morning. If we hadn't sorted it, we were going to announce receivership or going to administration at 7 a.m. And if we did succeed, we were going to announce that we'd refinanced and we were back on our playing field. And we had a board meeting through the night. We pulled it off, and by 7 o'clock, slightly weary, I was talking to Reuters and shareholders saying, we sorted it. But it came down as close. That's very unpleasant. And from a director as well, of course, you've always got the problem that if somebody in retrospect decides that you were trading whilst insolvent because you should have been aware that you were running out of cash, there's unlimited personal liability on a director. So the stress levels on any director, exec or non-exec, shoot up. So I'm afraid that's the worst, because you've got personal liability, you've got no one wanting to help you, and you are very worried. You don't want your business to go bust. You know, that is the ultimate failure for a director.
So how did you solve that at 2:30 in the morning, and what did you learn from that experience?
We sorted it by 2 or 3 months of really hard work, talking to our shareholders. And this was a point where we had to be honest to our shareholders. We had to make them insiders, and we had to tell them exactly the situation. And we also had to raise a bond. So we had to find, I think we had three cornerstone investors who believed in the business. and we a bit of bullying, because the only thing you've got is you saying to the bank in this situation, who had the derivative, if you pursue this and you don't, for example, help us, you're not going to get your money because we're going bust. So the only thing you have is the threat that you're going to go bust. And what did I learn? Well, look, Assura was and is a brilliant business, right? It runs GP surgeries. Almost all the income comes from the government, okay? So it was a brilliant company, fantastic company, but it came within a couple of short hours of going bust because of mismanagement of the finance, which was principally misunderstanding of derivatives. And, you know, that's a lesson that, you know, if you look at the property companies that came out of the 2008-09, where people bought swaps, and swaps very easily become toxic. And in my book, I give 8 questions that anybody should ask about a derivative, right? They're very, very specific questions, because, you know, so few people understand even simple derivatives, and even fewer people understand the awful consequences, the detail of exactly what can happen. And that's one of the big things. And I'm afraid I've seen it. I joined the board of Mitchells and Butlers. That had a very famous £400 million loss on a swap. I'm afraid these misuse of derivatives and in some cases close to mis-selling by banks of derivatives was a big factor post the great financial crash.
So beyond derivatives, what are the most important financial metrics for the board to be aware of?
I tend to, if you're going to challenge me on being really tough, I look at 2 things. One is PBT or EPS. Okay, they're virtually the same thing. Okay, not operating profit. Whenever I see somebody talking about operating profit, I make a face like it, because it means they're not worried about cash. And my second one is cash. Now, you see, I think the regulators have done investors and companies a big disservice, because the cash flow statement is unintelligible. It's just gobbledygook. And what I think, because it comes down, it focuses on liquid resources, i.e. effectively cash or quasi-cash. Well, if you really are down on your uppers, then liquid resources are important. But for the vast majority of companies, if you're thinking about debt, you should think about net debt, right? Which would obviously includes debt as well as pure liquid resources. So when I think about movement in cash flow, I look about changes in net debt. And that number is not on the cash flow statement these days, because these clever professors and the ISB think they know much more because they're academics, not business people. So and it takes a while. You can get it. So, you know, businesses, I still think after all these years, don't take enough focus off cash. And because they tend in turn in a board meeting to replicate the statutory cash flow, that is even less unintelligible. Okay, if investors think, gosh, I can't work out this cash flow, that's all right, because most of the people in the boardroom can't understand it either. All right, so PBT and cash, those are the 2 things that I think are absolutely the heart of financial metrics.
And if we look at something like Patisserie Valerie, if you'd have been on the board there, do you think you could have spotted the potential issues and avoided its demise, so to speak?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? The thing about fraud is it's very difficult to spot. You know, often in audit committee, you'll say, we've had a bit of fraud. And people say, we've got to stop fraud. And I'm thinking, you might as well talk to the government and say, we've got to stop crime. Why doesn't the government stop crime? Well, because it's pretty, I'm afraid it's pretty pervasive, and it's extremely difficult to do. So the answer is fraud is very difficult. Let me take you an example in a certain business I was involved in. This isn't fraud, but it's close, where we were looking at losses on loans, and the loss rate was low, and we were thinking pretty good about that. The loss seemed, well, we can't really have a problem because the loss rate, I can't remember, 1% or something. It was only later on that we found out the management was capitalizing the losses. So what they did was, when the losses were 3 months old, they went back and they said, okay, instead of you offering owing us 100,000, you now owe us 105,000. So they upped the principal and didn't show the 5,000 unpaid interest as a loss, simply as an increased loan. Now that's shocking. It's a real example, I'm afraid. Very, very difficult for an audit committee to spot that unless somebody sticks their hands up and says, look, there's an accounting policy change here. I think over the years, I've looked for things I think boards or investors should look for, right? Those sort of hints. And frankly, you're working on hints because there's no straightforward answer to a lot of these things. And if you look at Tim Steer's book, which is, The Signs Were There, or you look at Terry Smith's book, Accounting for Growth, both good books that investors should read about clever accounting schemes. The thing I say to people, if there is trouble, if there is naughtiness, it's in the balance sheet, not the P&L. And most people focus on the P&L, all right? But skeletons are always in the cupboard marked balance sheet, because if you are diddling something through the P&L, the chance are 99% you've got to park it in the balance sheet because there's a double entry. All right. So I always say to people, look hard at the balance sheet. And I don't know about Patisserie Valerie, but I looked at Carillion and I did a post hoc analysis of Carillion. And it's on my website. And you can see in retrospect the working capital going up, which was quite a key sign. But other things to look at, one is phasing of revenue and profit. When the revenue and profit becomes phased at the back end of the year, that's not necessarily wrong, but it's an amber flag, right? And I think we've seen that. We saw that, I think, in Patisserie Valerie. They had increasing amounts coming in at the end of the year. Segmental profit is important, and this is often gets forgotten. So there's quite good segmental analysis in an annual report now, and you can see in Carillion they were putting a lot of emphasis on growing a segment of their business that had low profitability. And when I looked at the annual report data, I thought, how did they justify investing in the Middle East, which had low profitability and appeared to have poor working capital? So segmental profit, as I say, cash flow, net debt, go and have a look. Is net debt rising or not? The security of debt facilities. I mean, people often say we've got fantastic debt facilities. Have a look in the detail of the notes, whether they are cancelable or not. Because in one or two of the collapses that have happened, people had facilities, but you know the phrase, when the sun's shining, the bank will lend you an umbrella. When it's raining, they'll take the umbrella back. So watch, and sometimes you can see it in the annual report. I've talked about derivatives. Be very, very careful of derivatives. They're very complex. Be careful of the pension scheme. So look, those are a few of, as a practitioner, those are a few of the warning signs. None of them are perfect though. You can get caught. And the other thing I tell my colleagues on boards, I say the guys who are defrauding us are the people you like the most? Because people have said to me so often, Mr. X, Mrs. X, they've screwed us. They were inventing, and they were such nice people. I said, yeah, con men are really, really nice people. That's how they con you.
But in general, do you think board directors of PLCs and the city generally have a good moral compass?
I think most people are honest, not everybody, obviously. I mean, you can follow the Theranos with Elizabeth, can't remember her name, but the Theranos, fascinating case. And you sit there and you think, she must have known that what she was peddling didn't work, simply didn't work, and that people were suffering. So I think most people do. What I would say is that in the height of battle, people lose their sense of direction. People can lose their sense of direction. And it's another thing I say to directors, always, when the sweat is hitting the brow, maybe it's 2 a.m. in the morning, you've had a really tense, difficult discussion with lots of advisors and lawyers, stop and say, what's the right thing for our shareholders? Now, and I think that's really important. And I've had a few occasions in my life where the lawyers or the advisors, the bankers have said, I think you might be a good idea to do that. And I said, but that wouldn't be right. That wouldn't be the best outcome for our shareholders. And they said, I know, but you cover your backside and you'll make this. And a few times I said, no, we've got to do what's right and live with the consequences. And I genuinely believe that in general, if you do the right thing, people will accept it. Yeah. People want to say, do this because the shareholders want you to do this. And I said, no. We must do what we think is right for shareholders, and then we have to convince them afterwards. And in my experience, most boards will accept doing the right thing.
And how should we as investors feel about LTIPs? And from a board perspective, how do you feel about LTIPs?
Yeah, uncomfortable. If we're honest, I think remuneration is a very tricky subject. Boards spend far, far too much time on it. I cannot tell you, you know, how much time boards spend on remuneration. And it's very, very frustrating. I know there's often, if you read the newspapers, you think that, you know, non-execs are desperate to pay huge fees to directors. And it's not really true. You know, directors have made some pretty big howlers. One of the things I say in my book is always, always, always cap an incentive scheme. Okay? Because if an incentive scheme is going to pay out absolutely hand over fist, there's probably been an element of luck involved in there. Either that or you've got the targeting completely wrong. Neither of which are great reasons to pay people. So we shouldn't be paying CEOs 65 million in bonus and things like that. I think it's ridiculous. And I think we don't really take account enough of the fact that, but you know, long-term schemes, which I think have an important role, but they have two. One is there's an awful lot of luck involved. Okay, your competitor goes bust, the market grows, a pandemic causes a mass increase in digital participation, right? So there's an enormous amount of luck. And secondly, LTIPs tend to ride the cycle. So if you sort of imagine profit going up on a waveform, if you have one or two bad years, the chances are the third LTIP will start from a very low base. That then has the potential of paying out very handsomely, even when you're just on recovery from the dip. So, I mean, my main view on remuneration is, one, It's not an incentive. I mean, there are some managers, there are some directors who are totally focused on money. The term is they're coin operated. Most aren't. Most turn up to do a good job and they get the pleasure from doing a good job and being seen to do a good job and benefiting their career. In which case, it's a thank you from the shareholders. It's a participation in the success. So, I think if there's a lot of nonsense going on about it being an incentive, and really I see it very, very little incentive, right? But I think it is the sort of reward that you have to pay to get the best people. And the thing is, are you getting the best people? Because I've seen some pretty mediocre people get multi-million pound fees and bonuses. And I've seen some pretty damn good people who get very little because the performance has been against them and they're brilliant, but they've not managed to turn things around. So it's a very, very imprecise art. I think it's important that we do have long-term incentives, right, so that people don't just get paid out on short term. But I think we have to be careful that an LTIP really pays out for good performance rather than luck or riding the cycle.
And should they be nil cost or should they just be at a preferential rate?
Think there's a, I mean, LTIPs, I mean, nil cost LTIPs are very, very geared. And this is part of the problem that they tend to exacerbate when you've had a bit of luck or you've ridden the cycle. The payouts are huge. And when things have gone badly, which is sometimes when, if you've got a good manager and things have gone badly because there's been a downturn in the economy or pandemic has grounded all your aircraft, you still want those really good people. And yet it's difficult to pay them because the incentive scheme won't let you pay out. And yet you want these people. You need them more than ever. Right? I am a big believer that managers should, and non-execs actually, should own shares in the company. And, I get frustrated when I see some RemComs paying out vast quantities of vast fees, bonuses, even to people who've got quite large shareholding. And I'm thinking, hang on, they've got large shareholding. That should be their principal reward like other shareholders. So I think remuneration is terribly difficult. There's no easy answer to it. I think what we've done, I think the move to shorter notice periods is a good thing. I mean, when I was an exec, I had a 2-year notice period. Goodness me, right? And now I think we should be looking at 6 months, for example, because that's the reason you pay for failure. If someone has got a 1-year notice and you decide to terminate them, it's quite difficult to avoid paying them up to a year's salary. So I think a lot of the pressure on RemComs has been very, very good. Right? And that's one of the reasons why I tell you boards can spend more time discussing remuneration than they do strategy. In fact, I'm going to tell you, I think almost all boards spend more time discussing bloody bonuses than they do strategy. And that's I don't think that's right.
So, moving on here, how should investors and the board view acquisitions or a bid and the price that's being paid or offered and determining whether that's right and whether there's a good strategic fit?
Well, if you sort of divide into two, if you're looking at a company that's going to buy another one, so the acquirer, I think the thing to do is to make sure you understand the strategic fit. And there's a tendency for some companies to think that an acquisition solves all problems. So if you're a company that's got a strategic weakness, say your supply chain isn't very good, and you think, I'd quite like to grow my business. I know we're weak on the supply chain, so we buy another company. Unless that company is a supply chain specialist and you're going to just lift and shift their systems, the diversion of resources into the acquired company will make your strategic weakness worse. All right. So if you think a company has got a strategic weakness and it's doing an acquisition, be very, very careful about whether you think that will make the situation worse. Because I can guarantee you, when a company acquires another company, all the managers want to work in the acquired. It's a new train set. Everybody wants to work on it. Nobody wants to bother with the old supply chain problem, which has been around for ages. The only exception to that is if a business buys another one for scale, and scale is your weakness. Now, I mean, that is where you can see a clear strategic link addressing an existing strategic weak. But even then, if you take, for example, I mean, the best example of that was Morrison taking over Safeway in 2004, should have been absolutely straightforward. Two food retail businesses, crunch them together, you get scale. But because that was so mismanaged by the then management, that all fell apart. So even there, what looks like straightforward can still hit. And what I say to my boards is, an acquisition doesn't create value. An implementation plan creates value, right? Because boards spend far too much time, and indeed the media focuses on how much are you going to spend, right? And if, for example, I was in CDR at the moment, talking about Morrison's, if I was in CDR, you know, and all right, they paid 1 pence per share more than Fortress did, and I'm sure they spent hours and hours debating that penny. But the measure whether that is successful is not that 1 penny. It's whether they implement it successfully, whether they lose management, whether they have innovation and new ideas that the existing management haven't got, right? It's the post, that is the crucial thing. So, you know, if I was going to evaluate an acquisition, I would always start, I mean, I'd look for the strategic rationale, strategic weaknesses. Is it going to make life worse? But then my second one is, what's the implementation plan? If you screw that up, you're lost.
And do you have much of a view on how you arrive at the price that you pay for an acquisition, or how much you're offered if you're being bid for?
Yeah, that's, in a sense, it's an art. But then more importantly, it's probably a negotiation. With any negotiation, the trick is to have two bidders. Okay. The reason that Morrison's got a 60% premium to their undisturbed share price was because there were two bidders. Right? That's right. It made it easy because the two bidders simply bid against each other, and they'll end up paying, you know that if you've got two keen bidders, they'll end up overpaying. I mean, maybe not a lot overpaying, but they will, because of the testosterone, right? And because you can tell because one company thought it was worth 1 pence a share more than the other. So, you know, half the experts think that CDR have overpaid. So the trick is to have two bidders, and you're in real trouble when, you know, if you're being bid for and life is a bit tough and there's only one bidder. I mean, for example, when Flybe was bought, where I was chairman, the two bidders came together, and suddenly the two bidder competitive tension that we had disappeared, and they came together, and there's no doubt that's why they came together, was to make sure they could bid a lower price. Now, that didn't work out for them because they had two different implementation plans and two different parties with different objectives and two different schemes, and the implementation did not go well. So that goes back to my other point. The general rule in the city is a 30% premium to the undisturbed price. So unless you're in a bit of trouble, if somebody comes to, the first bid that you get might well be at a 25% premium. And you know the first bid won't be the last bid. So if he's come at 25, you know they're prepared to go to 30. So you reject it. I'm simplifying, but giving a sort of idea. And then it becomes a matter of, does the board think 30% is enough? How confident is the board in its own projections? And a board will have lots of comparisons coming from the bankers will come with packs that thick. And they'll have a number of ways of valuing. They'll have NPV. And my advice is to throw the NPV calculation out. It's completely useless. It's generally the highest. The reason it's the highest is that they discount it back, broadly speaking, by your WACC, by the cost of capital. And that doesn't take account of risk. And if you're working on a management set of forecasts that's got 15% earnings growth a year for 3 years, that's fantastic. You wouldn't take that at the word. You would say that's high risk to get 3 years of 15%. So the NPV is no good, and I always throw it out. But the bankers, I promise you, will have it. The thing they'll look at, the next is comparables. Okay, so comparable ratios, and that's what you're really going to look at, and you're going to say, is a 10 times EBITDA or a 12 times PE ratio, that's what company X and Y are currently trading for, and company Z was bought out, and it was bought out at a 14. So those are the sort of ratios, but in the end, you have to remember, and the media forget this. There are two sorts of decisions. One is the company can decide not to put the decision to a shareholder vote. And two is it puts it to a shareholder vote. If it puts it to a shareholder's vote, well, okay. The owners make the decision. The board gives a view. And it's democracy, it's capitalist democracy. The shareholders have a vote. Where shareholders get very upset, especially the institutional shareholders, if somebody comes to you with a 30% premium and you choose not to put it to a vote, and I've had on a few occasions where an institutional shareholder said to me, look, if you get a bid at that level, I want to take the decision, not you. Okay? I'm the shareholder, I take the decision. And they mark your card and say, okay, as a chair or a non-exec, you say, okay, I understand, message received, you're the owner. Yeah, it's your business. And so sometimes a company will put an offer that the journalists will be writing that offer is hugely inadequate. They did, initially with the first offer the Morrisons took. Now Morrisons knew there were two bidders, so they knew that the first offer they took wasn't the offer they were going to accept. They were blowing the starting whistle on a bidding war and the price correctly. So they handle that correctly. So sometimes you can get a first an offer coming that you might think is a bit mean, but you might find that the board felt that they had to give the shareholders a say. And the shareholders say, and it does happen, reject it, that's fine. But most of the shareholders, if an offer looks quite good, most shareholders rather take the ultimate decision than have the board not pass it on. And we've had all the other criticism we've had of boards, it was again came up this summer, was that boards weren't revealing. There was quite a fuss in, I think it was the Telegraph and the Times, of the columnists saying, look, people have made, the initial offer to Morrisons wasn't revealed. Shareholders have a right to know. And I've tried to pick it up with some of these journalists and said, you do realize that public companies get offers all the time, and most of them are spurious, right? And they can be for reasons such as people, dodgy hedge funds trying to create some interest in the stock. And this happened, I think, a few years ago with L'Oreal, where a completely apparently bona fide offer was a complete chimera, didn't really exist. And somebody was trying to trade the stock. So And I can't tell you how many letters you get from PE firms that you've never heard of, saying that they're in possession, they're ready to make a bid, they've got all their funds arranged for you, and you've never heard of them, and the bank's never heard of them, and you ignore it, and you never hear anything more. So that's why boards don't reveal all the offers that they get.
So, in summary, how can us investors spot a bad board?
Yeah, that's tough. That's really difficult. I think there are some things you can look out for, right? It's obviously easier if you know any of the individuals, right? And I have to say, before I invest in a company, I do look very carefully at the board and try and get some sort of reference on the board directors. And sometimes you can tell what the board is like by the sort of board directors they've got. Do they look like people who've got a good pedigree? Do they look like they've chosen somebody just because they wanted someone who looks like that, but that individual CV looks pretty ropey? I don't think boards do a very good job in justifying new directors, you know. And I think that's a criticism that could be made of my boards too, by the way, that we tend to. We go through a very vigorous process, always using headhunters, rational criteria. We do a really, really honest, thoughtful job, and we say, right, Mr. or Mrs. X is the right person. And then we just put them up for vote. And sometimes you say we're because I've got great strategic experience or something. So I think investors could and should challenge boards more on why a director is right. I think you can look for that quality experience. Has that person been in a tricky situation? Because, you can look at tricky situations two ways. You can either say, oh, that person got into a real shtick here. I won't employ them. Or you say, that person got into real shtick. I wonder what they learned from that. And it's one of the questions I ask when I interview non-execs. I always like to look and find somewhere where they had a real tricky problem, right? And I say to them, what did you learn? And if they give me some good things they've learned, I like to employ them. If they tell them, if they give me some nonsense, I don't. So I don't mind people who've seen bad times. I look for overboarding. There are some directors who do far too many jobs. I personally think four non-execs, of which only two should be chair at most. So I'm very suspicious of people who've got seven or eight, right? I look for trophy non-execs, people you think, oh, I've heard of that person, they're on the telly, right? And I think you should beware of sudden turnover of directors. Directors leaving before 6 years. If a director has done 6 or more years, then there's a very good chance their time served and they're moving on. If someone leaves after 2 or 3 years, you should ask questions. And I think directors increasingly ought to, if they do go because they think something's not right, should give some indication of that. And I think the other thing is, I personally, as an investor, I look at the webcasts because I like to look at and listen to these managers talking and form a view. Are they bullshitters? Do they look like they believe in the company? Do they look like they know what they're doing? Are they interesting? And I'd encourage, I know AGMs have, AGMs are rather quiet affairs, particularly in the pandemic. But I'm surprised at how few, investors who sometimes have quite a lot of money actually turn up to an AGM. I know it's a bit of a pain, but it is your chance. When they turn up, so few really good questions are asked. And I think that does a service to all shareholders to go and ask, Can you just explain the strategy in Asia again to me? Because I don't really understand it. You know, those sort of questions. And to be honest, as a director, I love it when shareholders turn up and ask questions like that. I mean, you hate it when they sort of say, I'm fed up because the biscuits you serve in the store in Hay-on-Wye aren't very good. That's a real example, by the way. But, you know, that's what frustrates you. Never frustrates you when somebody asks you a really a good strategic question.
Thank you, Simon, so much for so many tremendous nuggets. Tell people where they can find more about you and more about the book.
Yeah, so the book is called Behind Closed Doors, The Boardroom, How to Get In, Get On, and Make a Difference. And it's like a sort of Haynes manual for the boardroom. It's very, very practical. It's full of tips. And this, if you are in a situation, I'll give them an answer, you know, like if somebody proposes a derivative, these are the eight questions you should ask. And there's lots about shareholders and dealing with shareholders and private shareholders and regulation. And it's available at Amazon and all good bookshops. Amazon got it for £11.29 at the moment, which I promise you is a bargain. And my website is www.simonlaffin.com, where there's more detail.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, please comment on our content on the different platforms. It means a lot to us and it helps us get the very best guests. Also, click subscribe at piworld.co.uk on the right-hand side at the top to get a notification of a new video as it's published with no spam. Many thanks for listening and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.